second room, the meaner breathing of her from the master court. He was alarmed then, when she was there in the hallway, wearing her cappuccino slip, her shoulders bare, her breastplate bare, a slice of light from the skylight piercing down on her, her hair all wild and unkempt. He had a mind to grab her immediately on seeing her like that, to rush at her and lick at her shores, to capture her, suck her, eat her, fill her up and make her burst in a storm of love all over him, succumb to him the way she used to. But she said, "Where the fuck have you been?" And he was smiling nevertheless because he couldn't help it, because of the swirling she was making inside him just by standing there like that, that she could still do this to him. Even now, even after everything. "I went for a drink," he said, his shoulders wet from the rain. "Where? With who?" "With Damien, in Brixton. The Wileys were doing a thing, so we passed through afterwards." She snorted, looking disgusted and appalled. "And you couldn't even call to say where you were. I've been trying to call you for hours. You couldn't even answer the phone." "It's out of battery," he yelled. "Well, why didn't you call? Didn't it even occur to you to call? What's wrong with you?"
"I'm sorry, okay?"
He swayed, and she saw his mouth was loose from drink.
"Jesus, man, it's Friday night. I went out. What? I'm not even allowed to go out now."
She kissed her teeth to the highest octave she could manage, which was quite high. Her teeth kissing had advanced over the years. She had adopted some of his Jamaicanness. It endeared her to him more. The whiskey haze was awash all over her, in her contours, her curves, her lines. He went towards her with soft eyes.
"Don't be like that," he said, pulling her into an embrace. "Come here, my empress. Just come here and tell me you love me."
His arms were around her, the octopus engulfing her, his smell of booze and dry clean suit. She struggled against it, but he was stronger than her. He did not realize quite how strong he was being in that moment, how strongly he was applying that strength. The bulls of the Assyrian court were stamping. The lions in the Alhambra court were roaring. She shouted, "Get off me!" and pushed him, with such a force that his grip loosened and he was caught by a strange fury that seemed not quite his, to belong to an older version of himself, one that had been suppressed by her, by living by her scripture, by the world outside. He retrieved his grip.
"You're supposed to be my woman," he said. "You're supposed to be my wife, remember? You're playing with me. You're supposed to love me, don't you know that? I am not your woman. I'm not anybody's woman."
She wrenched his arm away and ran into the kitchen. She did not know where she was going. The house was a prison. It was cursed. She did not want to go upstairs because she might wake the children. And the night thing that was Lily and that was getting inside Rhea was up there, and she couldn't bear the sound of the floorboards. She wanted to go outside, but it was raining. And even if she could get out back, there was only that mean square of concrete and the barrier of fence to escape to. She was trapped. Michael followed her. He was saying sorry, but she kept on walking away from him. Once she reached the passage, there was nowhere else to go, and she started to weep.
"Look, Mel," he said, reaching out for her. "Let's just..."
"Don't call me Mel! I hate it when you call me Mel!"
She swung round to face him. He said,
"Okay,"
curtly, putting his hands up, then turned and went to the wine rack. He needed more. He too needed to escape. He found a glass and poured with a miserable, defeated expression on his face, the beginnings of an old man. The drinking was giving him a paunch.
"Don't you think you've had enough? You're drunk."
"Yeah, and I have every reason to be coming home to this shit."
"Coming home to this shit? Try being at home with this shit. Do you have any idea what I've been dealing with here today? Oh yes, you don't, because you didn't answer your phone. But if you had answered your phone, you would know that Rhea is sick now too. She's got Blake's tonsillitis, and there's something... Oh God, you have to listen to me, Michael. There's something horrible happening. There's something evil in this house. There is. There is. Don't tell me I'm being ridiculous or I'm overthinking it because I'm not. You're not here all day to know what's happening. All I know is that we've got to get out of here. We've got to. I'm scared of what will happen to her if we don't. What if she takes Blake too?
Who? What if who takes Blake?
He was looking at her full of derision, like a doctor who would look at a patient he has given up on. She whispered it.
Lily.
He wanted to laugh. He held it back. At least he tried his best to. But a little bit of it came out by itself. It was not that he found it funny, as much as that he didn't know how to respond. He felt speechless, as if she had exited to another world, and they had lost their language. His face then, after the bit of laughter, assumed a calmer look, that first kindness she had loved in him, but with a sharp edge.
Okay, he said, in this calmer, factual tone, moving the bottle to one side on the kitchen counter. Don't take this the wrong way, all right? But I think there's something going on with you, Mel. Sorry, Melissa, that you need some help with. Lots of women get postnatal depression after having a baby. It's common. Damien was saying Stephanie had it after Summer was born. It's an actual real thing. I've been reading about it online. It can happen to anyone. Yes, even you. It can cause delusions, breakdowns. I'm serious, man. You need to talk to someone. It's worrying, the way you're carrying on. Listening to this, a bitter, spiteful determination had taken over Melissa's body, curling her lip inwards, clenching the sinews in her arms, her shoulders. She wanted to hurt him. She wanted to make him feel small and humiliated and dismissed the way he was making her feel. Why, thank you, she sneered. Thank you so much for your concern. Is that what you've been doing all evening, huh? Sitting there with Damien talking about your crazy woman. Your postnatally depressed woman who won't fuck you anymore. You clueless, insensitive bastard. Did Damien make any other suggestions, perhaps? Any other revelations? Did he enlighten you at all on how to get down with this woman? On what to do when there's trouble in paradise? Did he tell you to go and sleep with someone else's woman instead, like he did? What do you mean? What are you talking about?
Melissa glared at him, waiting for it to dawn on him. When it did, it cut him right through his heart. It went straight into the blade of light and set him on fire. It was a physical pain. It broke him, like he'd told Perry she would one day, all that time ago in Montego Bay.
You?
He shrank with the word, afraid of it.
Yeah, that's right. Me.
With Damien? You mean you and Damien?
He laughed again, only very briefly. He had taken on some of Melissa's habit of laughing in response to something negative. He looked haggard suddenly, his shoulders and torso hanging limp in his suit.
Are you kidding me?
No, I am not kidding you. Melissa started to feel cold along her arms and chest. A fear, a different kind of fear, was stealing up on her. She went past him into the living room to get the blanket from the sofa and wrapped it around her, partly just to get away from him for a minute, to not have to behold the expression in his eyes, the hurt, the incredible hurt, the wet shine of it. She did not go back into the kitchen, but stayed near the dining table, looking in at him through the doorway, from the shadows.
When?
He said. Her voice quietened. In Spain.
In Spain? When in Spain? When we were all there, together?
He wanted to know everything, every detail, the exact circumstances. He forced her to tell him. The pool, whether she had liked it, what shape, how many times. Then he exploded and kicked over the dustbin. As he did so, more sawdust came spilling out onto the paprika from the gash in the wall. The storm shook the house with another blast of thunder. The monkeys in the monkey house were screaming. The parrots in the parrot house were shrieking. The mice under the bath were playing their violins in a frenzy.
And he was there,
Michael said.
He was there tonight, drinking with me, chatting with me like nothing's happened.
What are you so angry for? Melissa said. You did the same thing, remember? You went there first. I didn't react like this, did I?
Oh, so is that why you did it? To get back at me?
No.
Why then?
Why'd you go there with him, of all people? He's my friend. How can you disrespect me like that?
Melissa could hear the lullaby again, playing from above, drifting down the stairs.
If that mockingbird won't sing, Mama's gonna buy you a diamond ring. If that diamond ring turns brass, Mama's gonna buy you a looking glass. She glanced up towards the halfway landing. An upper floorboard creaked.
It was... I didn't...
But she lost her train of thought.
I'll tell you why I'm angry, Michael said. Let me tell you why I'm so upset.
And the words of John Legend's "used to love you" were reverberating in his head as he did so.
It's because I love you. That's why. Hear that? At least I used to love you, because I'm not so sure I do anymore. So yes, it hurts me that you've shared your body with someone else. That was my temple, my sacred place. It was mine. Get it? I've been dying here, waiting and waiting for you to let me in, and you go with someone else, with Damien. Oh, man. And do you want to know the reason why I have to explain this to you? Why you can't even work it out for your fucking self? The reason you didn't react like this? Well, that's because you don't love me. You never have you? I can see it now. I think I've known it all along, but I was too scared to face it. I'm so stupid. I'm so fucking stupid.
He had backed away towards the passage, so that the shape of him filled the failed double doorway, the top of his head almost touching the frame. There were tears coming down his face. His mouth was slack and distorted. There was a new, deeper bend in his posture, a caving in, almost immediate, like a plant that was wilted in an instant, yet the actual movement is impossible to witness. She watched him, full of compassion, wishing she had not told him. It would have been better if she hadn't told him. It was nothing to her, what the body did or whom it belonged to. It was different from love. Love was a palace, and the body was just an object inside it. But he didn't see it that way, to his detriment. How could she explain it to him?
I do love you, she said.
But it felt like someone else was saying it, not her true self, which was somewhere outside these walls. He was shaking his head, refusing.
No, you don't. You can't. You're a liar. I've never been enough for you. I've never been what you wanted. I bet you think being with me is the biggest mistake of your life.
No, no. It's not true.
You think I'm a failure. You think I've put you in a cage the way your dad put you in a cage. That I've forced you to live such a plain and ordinary life, the same as everybody else. Do you think I wanted to be this? Do you think I wanted... Michael, look!
Behind him, just missing the back of his head, Erica Badu fell to the floor in her frame. Her glittered sky-blue boots, her raised fist and shimmering dreads, their glass home shattered, sending shards of light across the paprika. Before the picture had fallen, Melissa had seen it slide first to one side on the wall and then the other, making itself crooked like the dancers, before coming fully off its nail at some secret pressure from behind. Now Barack Obama was doing the same thing, his calm and thoughtful face dipped to one side, then the other side, smashing as it landed.
What's happening? Michael said.
I told you, see? She's doing it. She's here, all over the house. I have to save her. Help me, Michael. I can't do it on my own.
The felled dustbin rolled across the floor by itself. More sawdust came spilling out of the wall.
It's the wind. It's just the wind, Michael said, closing the window. Can't you hear the storm? Come with me.
She was holding out her hand to him from beneath the blanket, pleading with him, moving from one bare foot to the other on the kitchen step. She was all gone now, that woman she once was, that light creature, that lovely flame. He had lost her, and this woman here before him, he did not know her. Directly above her head, Melissa, the other Melissa, she was no longer sure which one was which. Heard the floorboards moaning again, creaking and bending and resounding a terrible pressure. She was coming. She was trailing her white hand along the wavy black line. She was coming down the first three stairs. One step, another, quicker step. One step, another, quicker step. It was almost too late. Melissa ran to the bottom of the stairs and looked up. She would be coming now. Yes, there, turning into the halfway landing, that dreadful crooked gate, to come to a pause underneath a skylight. Looking down at them, it was her. Rhea was almost all gone. The powdered hands, the shine of the brooch. The face was too thin, no light in it, only in the brooch. And she was so pale.
Oh, God,
Melissa said, clutching the blanket to her chest. Michael was behind her now.
Daddy,
the girl said, the voice too deep and a different accent. Daddy.
Don't touch her. It's not Rhea.
The girl reached out her white hand to her father and started descending towards him.
Lily, stop!
Melissa shouted. She thought that if she exercised the courage to address her directly and with force, she would listen. Michael turned to her, feverish, with anger and confusion.
What?
He said.
She's taken her. She's making her sick. What are you talking about? This is Rhea. It's Rhea, your daughter. Daddy!
Lily called out.
I don't feel well. Get away from her. Get away from my daughter.
Melissa went up and grabbed Lily by the arm, feeling disgusted by her awful white hand, tugging at her as though Lily were a coat that must be taken off. There was the sound of crying, this close, too deep ghostly crying, and another smaller crying, a baby from further away.
Hey!
Shouted Michael. But he was too late. Lily shook Rhea from the inside as Melissa was trying to pull her off, so that Rhea stumbled. She came tumbling down the last seven stairs, down the wavy black lines on either side, and rolled to a heap in his arms, her skin burning hot, her pajamas soaked through with sweat. There was a horrified silence in which everything came to stillness, even the storm. The house was holding its breath. Michael said, his face consumed with hatred.
Look what you've done.
And Melissa saw the crumpled girl at the bottom of the stairs. She was shivering. Her face was hidden away. The back of her neck was like Rhea's neck, soft, with the dark down.
Oh, she said. Oh,
catching herself in the hallway mirror and not recognizing herself. She saw only the creature who Michael hated. There, in the glass. She saw the picture from her dream of the two of them in the boat, her wildly rowing, he lying dead, and she understood now that it was his love that was dead, not his body, and hence she was alone, but without herself. She was untraceable, irretrievable. She did not know where she was, and so she did not know what to do. All around her there was a sense of things throbbing and vibrating. The leaves of the peace lily by the window twins were gently shaking. The frames of the windows themselves seemed to be bulging outwards. The curve of the ecclesiastical arch was pulsating. The black flecks of the inner trees of the crooked floorboards were rising. The other pictures in the passage of the heroes were sliding, melting, losing their solidity.
I have to get out,
she said, backing away towards the front door.
I have to get out of here. Something's happened to me. I've lost something.
She lifted her arms, looking down at them as if studying some unknown object.
I have to get out,
she cried again, as the throbbing spread further and further outwards, becoming more violent. It was below her, above her. The dancers in the master court were tumbling. The birds in the Tanzania square were twitching. The raffia at the windows was splitting. The toy figures outside in the playhouse were snapping. The yellow teddy bear on the red bench was rocking. All around her, the dust was falling, raining down. She swung open the front door and ran out into the street, the blanket still around her shoulders, but her feet bare. And as she walked quickly along the damp pavement, she could hardly feel its wetness. Down she went to the bottom of Paradise, looking for her house. And up she went to the top of Paradise, searching for herself. Past the block of flats where Pauline's light was still turned off, around the corner where the red-lit peak of the Crystal Palace Tower came into view. And there the throbbing grew bigger still, took on a greater, older stature. The sculptures in the Grecian court were crumbling. The tiles in the Moorish court were cracking. The frescoes on the ceiling of the Renaissance court were dissolving. The lions in a circle in Alhambra were howling. The bulls of the Assyrian court were stamping. The tomb of Beni Hassan was opening. The colossi of Abu Simbel were toppling. And the ferro-vitreous edges of the ferro-vitreous arches were loosening. And the heads of the statues of the Greeks in the grasses were rolling. And the dinosaurs made of old science were groaning. The spirals of the spiral staircases were spinning. The mummies in the Egyptian court were wailing. The echoes in the organ loft were deafening. The big glass panes of the central transept were crashing. And it was there, in the central transept, that on that cold November night in 1936, the final fire started. It began quietly, as fires often do, with a small orange flame. It swept through the transept in its fast red gown, taking the spirals, the arches, the inside elms and the crystal walls. Into the aviaries it went, sending the birds flying out into freedom. The manacles and the Welsh gold were taken. The Indian silk and the obelisks were ablaze. The cannons, the lace, the Belgian chiffon, all lost in an inferno of molten glass and iron. The flames were visible from the southern shores of the English Channel, and when the fire was at its highest, a flock of those dark birds was seen circling above it, soaring and lifting, higher and higher, up and out into the relative safety of Pissarro's skies. Chapter 14. The Worst Thing. The cemetery at Hither Green is set across a sweeping breadth of green hill at the very southern edge of London, close to places like Eltham and Lee, where many of us have never been. The graves form rows of grey stone arches along the wider arches of the hill, and their flowers are prey to the moods and extremities of the weather, which today is cool and pressing towards winter, the golds and reds of late October falling in the leaves, an east wind toying with their journeys to the ground, and carried on the wind a distant smell of wood smoke, marking the entrance to the cold season. Through these loose amber leaves, Damien walks on a day off from work, wearing trainers and a black parka, a light growth of neatened stubble over his jaw, looking for one grave in particular, which according to his map is in the northwest corner of the necropolis, in the third row down. The funeral seems like a lifetime ago, yet it is only a year. He cannot remember the direction the hearse took or where exactly it stopped, only the lowering of the coffin into the ground and the shoveling of the earth on top. How much earth it seemed, how deep it went. As he walks, he remembers these things more clearly, and it is as if he is attending for the first time, fully present. He is holding flowers. He also has one of his father's carvings from the boxes in the garage, an old man with hunched shoulders and streaks of white hair, which he intends to leave with him to change and erode with the climate. When he gets there, to the third row in the northwest corner, there is a woman at the foot of the grave, bending down and arranging some flowers. They are wonderful flowers, extreme in their colours, orange roses, gyp, bright yellows, a mass of them. The woman is wearing a purple coat with a yellow scarf. As Damien gets closer, he begins to recognise the movements of her hands, the way she bends strictly at the waist with her spine straight, and the backs of her knees pushed out. The colours she has chosen for her offering are the same colours that used to sit on the dining table and in the pots on the balcony. And her coat, most of all, the coat, the exact shade of the purple cardigan she used to wear. The gold of the autumn leaves at her feet are reminiscent of those gold buttons. She turns and looks at him. The same face, still bright, older.
Joyce? He says.
She smiles and opens her arms, gives him the biggest hug he has been given by another adult in a long time.
Look at you, all grown up,
she says, in a far-off voice, which resounds deep inside his head.
You're a man now, and guess what? Everything is going to be fine. Just fine. You watch.
He sat there with her, and they talked, until his flowers blended with hers, and the gold buttons faded away. A day of reckoning. The writing was finished. A play this time, about Michael Jackson faking his death in order to experience his glory. Nothing might ever come of it, and that was okay, for he would find the way. He would find his path. From Hither Green, he went to Blackfriars and took the tube to Embankment. By now, it was evening and darkness had fallen on the river. Whenever he came to the South Bank, he always got off the tube at Embankment rather than Waterloo, so that he could walk across this river and feel what it meant to be a part of it, containing as it did in its spirit the abundance of the city, the history of it, the souls of its people. He watched the silver of the lights on its ever-moving surface, felt the deep breathing of its tide out towards the ocean, and he beheld the magical sight of the blue-lit trees along the southern bank, which was always festive, always reaching for Christmas. The entire wall of the Royal Festival Hall was covered with a glittering curtain of white light, cascading down in a diagonal direction. There were crowds of people drinking on the terrace, walking among the trees, waiting at the carousel. He relished it, this power of London, to allow an escape from the self, for just a little while. In a munificence of surrounding, an enormous activity and excitement. He had arranged to meet Michael by the Madiba statue, outside the Royal Festival Hall at the top of the terrace stairs. They had not seen each other since their last drink at the Satay, when Damien had been locked inside the madness of his writing, his feet deep in cold water most evenings, and his calves bare. He had been happy, riveted, oblivious to almost everything, despite being on the brink of losing his job, despite Stephanie demanding that he set up a bed for himself downstairs until they decided what to do. He would work late into the night, like the old days, and smoke in the driveway during breaks, feeling connected to the stars as he looked up at them, their exquisite loneliness. When it was finished, he had saved it onto a USB, sent it to himself via email so that cyberspace would cushion it. Then he had risen, taken his feet out of the water and gone out for a run. Dorking had looked so different during that run, greener, colourful. He even discovered a basketball court down an alley off one of the neighbouring streets, which he had started using with the children. Michael had not been forthcoming about this meeting, which was understandable. Damien had persisted, though, desiring of some essential punishment, yet standing there in the cold next to Nelson, he had no idea what he was going to say to him, or what either of them could be expected to get out of seeing each other. Perhaps he should have let it lie. Perhaps he should have forced himself to forget that they had been friends. But the thing was that he missed him. It was partly selfish. He wanted to apologize, but he also wanted to know how he was. So when he saw Michael's head, adorned in a flat cap, appearing on his ascent up the stairs, bent at first, then lifting, Damien's first instinct was to go and knock his shoulder and give him dap. He was that pleased to see him. But he didn't. He waited, dutifully, for the tone to be set. He was looking sharp, he noticed, a thick black coat and a suit, a whole suit, walking the power of it in full effect. There was no shoulder knock or shake hand.
What are you saying? Michael said,
and Damien replied also with a question.
What's up?
Neither of which were answered strictly, and thus do not require question marks. Damien said,
You look well.
As Michael's face became stern, firmly set against him. 2 months ago, he had wanted to destroy him. Now, he felt a mere disconnection, along with an awkward kind of gratitude.
Been looking after myself. Been running a lot, he said.
Is it?
I've been running as well.
Michael did not reply. He had not come here to chat. There was a prickly silence between them while people went wading by, in couples and trios and crews, in their leggings and cowboy boots, their dinner jackets or skinny jeans, or symphony clothes, depending on which level and which building of the South Bank complex they were visiting. There was such an atmosphere of sociability around them, but they were not part of it. They couldn't quite drink together, definitely not eat together, and Michael maintained a meter's distance from Damien, facing outwards and away towards the river.
"Shall we walk or something?"
Damien said. They fell into step, and there was a little less bounce in Michael's step. He walked closer to the ground. He could still feel it, a coolness around his shoulders, the absence of something reassuring. She was no longer with him when he walked. There was only one dimension now. He was concentrating on strengthening it. And being here wasn't helping. Did Legend go for a walk with the guy he cheated at? He shouldn't have come.
"How are the kids?"
Damien asked as they reached the bottom of the stairs, turning towards the bank. It seemed the safest place to start, yet was tinged with guilt.
"Okay, considering," Michael said. "Rhea had that swine flu, though, back in summer. It was horrid. Knocked her out."
"No,
that was bad. I heard about that in the news. Was it really to do with pigs?"
"Yeah, it was. Something about the farms. Nasty, man.
You now say I've given up the pork now."
They came to the book market and paused, a breather. The cold was lifting off the river. Boys were making curves in the skate park underneath the bridge, boats drifting by with parties going on inside. Further down along the blue trees, there was a quieter place with some restaurants and bars set in a lane, and they came to that eventually. Michael had left Paradise, he revealed, and was living in a flat, an apartment, he called it, not far away. He had the children at weekends. Melissa had them during the week. She would also be moving soon.
"I'm sorry. I'm so sorry," Damien said. "I really didn't mean for it to happen. You have to know that. I was in a mess."
"Oh, please. We're all in a mess. You want to apologize? It's too late. It's irrelevant."
"But it's completely wrong. You two should be together."
"Why?"
Michael said, angrily.
"Because you work."
"We haven't worked in a long time."
"She loves you."
Michael gave a fierce, condescending look, made blue by the trees, and Damien was crushed by it. There would never be another side from this. They would not be able to get there. The water was too deep.
"It wasn't you, you know," Michael said in the end.
"That wasn't the reason. You were just a device in the machine of our breaking, and we needed to break. It's not so bad when it finally happens. You think the world is going to collapse around you, but it doesn't. You can see yourself clearly again. You realize that the fear was the worst thing."
They did drink together, for they were thirsty, in a bar down that quiet lane. It would be a last drink, and they spoke of other things for as long as they lasted. On the train on the way home, Damien thought about this idea of seeing yourself clearly again, of the fear being the worst thing. Somewhere in the pit of him, he was not quite envious, more watchful, accepting. They had taken that devastating step. Bags had been packed, schedules had been arranged. The physical reconstruction of domestic life had taken place. He had imagined it so many times, what his life might look like, feel like, in that singular apartment on a narrow London street. But to bring it to fruition was another thing, and he understood now that he did not have that kind of courage. He was a stayer, a settler. He had less spirit, perhaps, less adventure inside him. That difficult, more glorious, complex way was for the others, the people who had enough light inside themselves to bear the loss of some of it. Also, it seemed to him, on this side of the water. When he got home, Stephanie was sitting at the dining table, working on a collage of family photographs to put up on the wall. This was something she did at the end of every year. She gathered all of her favourite pictures, of holidays, days in the park, school plays and moments she wanted to remember at a glance around the house, and spread them out on the table. She surveyed them, the highlights of their lives, looking for a pictorial order, a symmetry of love. Then she made slow and careful selections and placed them in a meaningful arrangement on a piece of card, sticking them down only when the position of each photograph was just so, relating to the ones next to it, the whole thing conjuring an enduring celebration of how they lived. When this was done, she framed it and found a place for it. There was one in the kitchen, in a curlicued brass frame, two above the stairs, another in the hallway, and one in each of the bedrooms. In this way, their lives were caught in moments of rightness. Any chaos or discontent was brought to a point of stillness and calm. It gave hope to the coming year. It gave her faith in their continuance. She did not look up when he came into the room. He had been trying, since finishing his play, to retrieve her, talking with her, holding her sometimes, being present, engaging in the children's lives again. But some of her coolness remained. The house smelt of warm food recently cooked, lasagna, tomatoes. Usually she did the collage in December, in the days between Christmas and New Year.
"You're early," he said.
"I know, I just felt like it."
A photograph of Summer, Avril and Jerry at Stonehenge that spring had been chosen for the centre.
"I don't remember that one."
Damien went closer and peered over her shoulder.
"You weren't there," she said. "We had a fight that morning in the driveway, so I took them by myself. We had a lovely time, actually."
As he sat down with her at the table, she asked after Michael. He told her. He didn't want to lie about anything anymore. He was going to tell her everything she needed to know, because she was strong and good. She was a gateway to peace. He had felt it walking towards the house, walking up the path, opening the door. She was home, a place to stop and just be.
"They broke up. But why?"
How should he explain it? The February snow, the black tree and the cigarettes, and the Beatnik night, the big disappointment of it, a balloon descending, sinking to nothing.
"There was a device in the machine of their breaking, and that device, I think..."
Stephanie was looking at him, and there was something in her eyes, a mixture of gladness and concern, a surge of pride, of righteousness. She didn't let him finish.
"Are they working it out? They've got to work it out for the children's sake."
And she thought of the marriage guidance leaflets she'd picked up with the bereavement counselling ones back in January. She had not shown them to Damien. She hadn't wanted to. They'd seemed useless, draining, but she'd kept them just in case. She glanced towards the sideboard, trying to remember which drawer they were in. Then her eyes returned to the photographs, with a renewed sense of vision.
"That's why people get married," she said. "When you're married, it's harder to walk away. You're stuck with each other."
"Is that how you see it?"
"Isn't that how you see it?"
"No."
He picked up one of the photographs. It was of the two of them together, before they got married, taken in London, in Camden, by the canal.
"This is so old, man. Look how young we look."
"Well, I've been having problems finding recent ones of us." "There's none from this year, obviously, unless you've got some on your phone. I haven't."
"It's been a difficult year," he said.
"You think?"
As they worked on the collage together, Stephanie looked up and out at the garden at one point and placed her hand on her stomach under the table. She was about to say something. It was still early, and she had wanted to wait. But perhaps now was the right time. She had already decided that everything would be all right, with or without him.
"What?"
he said, noticing her watching him. Her eyes melted. She smiled, but looked down again. Another time. Soon. Let the life grow, regardless of what was outside.
"Do you have one of your dad?"
she said. Later, when she was getting up from the table, the edge of her slipper got caught in the leg of her chair. He went to free it for her, smelling the gist of her bright hair. She looked so pretty in that instant. He bent down and gently pressed the slipper back onto the heel of her foot. Chapter 15. Across the River. Over the river to the north. River through the heart of this city. River of centuries, of black and white histories. The passage from the south. The river that divides the divide. Driving across in a red Toyota saloon, the spires of Parliament, and the great slow eye of London that hardly moves when you're inside it. The quiet arches of the bridges, and the water trembling through, and the trees on the bank behind you as you cross, and the birds as they soar. Onwards to Victoria, along the high Buckingham Palace wall, to the roar of Hyde Park Corner, and the pricey tip of Knightsbridge passing there, coming off the roundabout, Park Lane, northbound. Melissa was going to see her mother. The children were in the back, Blake on the left, Rhea on the right. On the passenger seat were a bag of fruit, mangoes, apples and melon, and a bunch of pink roses. Alice liked pink. She took the North Carriage Drive off Marble Arch, and they sped past the wild grass and the Sunday runners, the Serpentine Lake in the distance, and the ghosts of the summer bladers who rolled alongside it, weaving in and out of skittles. Now the cold sun of December glittered across the plains. The trees were so many expired afros and fallen weaves, only the roots left, brown and naked in the austerity of winter. Then out again into the traffic of Bayswater, up westwards, approaching Kilburn, where Alice waited in her pink flat in her house hat and dashiki, her cardigan and her slippers, calling, "Is that you?" when Melissa buzzed, and coming down to answer the door clutching her walking stick. There she was, a shrunken woman in a foreign land, yet home to her children when they most needed it. This is where Melissa had come that time, when all the glass had fallen and the Sphinx had lost its nose. She had come alone with a suitcase and stayed for a week. This is where you come when you are lost, when you feel that you are never going to find the place. You go to the first place, the first country, to her net curtains and her singular food, to her safe and open door. You lie down, you eat, you listen to her. And you know that this house will not fall down. This house is sturdy and is made of bricks, and the wolf will not come and blow it down.
"You cut your hair," Alice said. "Why you cut your hair? It's too short."
"It's not that short," Melissa said, touching the back of it. It was short. She had been to the hairdresser and truncated the fro. She wore it pasted down to her scalp with gel, giving a boyish 1920s look. A new hair, a new her, with a grey streak. She had also been shopping with Hazel in Carnaby Street last week and dived into the clothes, feeling alive and fabric-y again. She had bought a poncho, which she was wearing today.
"You look nice," Alice smiled.
But she did hate the cutting of fros, anyone's, especially the good ones, when so many people struggle.
"Why you didn't dye that grey, though?"
"I like it." Alice laughed.
"You cannot walk around with white hair. It's secret of age."
This was a lost argument already, and she knew it.
"Go in," she said. "Mind the stairs with baby."
She had come up these stairs alone in old clothes and her longer hair carelessly tied back. She had ascended to the pinkness of paint, the heavily ornamented, hand-cushioned living room, the cluttered kitchen where it was always warm. Like a warm, dark womb, where the smell of a goosey filled the room, and Radio 4 was playing, and her mother was heating up some akara for her under the grill.
"Sit down, Omo,"
she had said, putting the akara in front of her.
"Eat."
And she did. Because you do not refuse the voice of your mother at a time like this, in fact, at any time, unless she is commanding something unreasonable or ludicrous, like,
"Don't talk to boys," or "Don't go out at night," when you are 38 years old.
She ate, neither of them talking much, just being comforted by the sound of Alice swishing and shuffling about the room, stirring the stew, mashing the eba, pouring the tea. The eba was fine eba, even through her tears which came here and there, even through the images that kept passing through her mind of that terrible night. her bare feet on the concrete, coming back to the quiet house and Michael waiting there, his face so drawn and resolute.
Where's Rhea? Where's Rhea?
She's upstairs. She's asleep. Leave her be.
Her leg is better,
Alice said now, having inspected Rhea's climb up the stairs. She went to play with Blake in the living room, where Alice had laid a piece of material over the carpet for them to mess up as they pleased. Blake especially liked the plastic telephone with the old-fashioned cord, which he dragged across the room with him, making calls. Rhea still liked the animal lorry that flipped down its door so that they all came tumbling out. Her hands were better too, smooth again.
I'm so glad to finally be out of that house, Melissa said, sitting in the same chair where she always sat at the kitchen table.
Alice was putting the roses in water. The akara was heating under the grill, and the eba was already mashed and separated.
One day you find a better house,
her mother said. But Melissa did not want another house. She was happier in the flat with the two bedrooms on the fourth floor in Gypsy Hill, high up again, the towers in the distance, which had become a landmark of home, a necessary reminder. She no longer wanted upstairs and downstairs, and a view of the houses on the other side of the street. It had been a relief. The mountain of boxes ready for leaving, the packing of the Czech marionette, and the Cuban mocha pot, the emptying of her wardrobe in the master court, then leaving, up paradise, left at the top, right at the end, away. Away. Behind the fridge when she was turning it off for the last time, she had found a dead mouse, its face closed and faded, covered in dust. Someone had scribbled over the word paradise on the street sign at the top of the road. So today, it was the four of them, sitting down to eat the eba and stew, on the plastic checkered tablecloth in the warm kitchen. Alice separated Blake's eba into small pieces. She was adamant that they should eat with their right hands, that any sign of left-handedness in a child should be destroyed as soon as it became apparent. To be left-handed was virtually to be disabled, she maintained, even though Melissa regularly pointed out that Barack Obama was left-handed, and it didn't seem to have affected him in a negative way. Alice's answer to this was that Barack's achievements were increased by the fact that he had become president despite his handicap, that if he had been able-bodied, things would have been easier for him, and he would have become president sooner.
How is new job? She said.
It's okay. Melissa had started teaching journalism at an adult education college.
That's right.
Are you still going to your Keep Fit classes?
It's too expensive,
Alice complained.
At first it was 40 pence. Then they said 1 pound. After that, they say it's 2 pounds. Now 5 pounds.
Thieves.
More, please,
Rhea said, and Alice got up, satisfied. After the eba, in her old clothes and her eyes swollen from crying, Melissa had dragged herself next door into the living room, where the pinkness was at its peak. It was a huge Victorian parlour, big enough for a single bed on one side, separated off by a curtain, where she had slept during that week. There was a cascade of turquoise butterflies hanging from the curtain rail at the window, and scores of photographs and ornaments. Warren and Lauren when they were little, Melissa and Carol at graduations, Alice and Cornelius on their wedding day, then two ebony elephants, a milkmaid, a sewing machine, various bunches of plastic flowers, crochet doilies, fans, feathers, several cabinets. There was such a paraphernalia of object in this room that it was impossible not to lose some of the urgency of your own personality when you were inside it, and to let yourself sink into the world of Alice, her unbroken cord with the motherland, her individualness, her private whispering. Here, Melissa had lain down on the sofa with its hand-sewn cushions, and even though it was summer then, Alice had put a blanket over her to keep her warm in case she got cold when she was sleeping. Before she went to sleep, Alice had also lent her her stress buster brick, given to her by a church friend. It was soft and made of rubber.
You squeeze it in your hand and make you feel better, she said,
and she demonstrated with her wrinkled, chocolate-coloured hand, offering it like a pusher, with the deepest and most sincere faith, as if she had invented it herself, rather than appropriated it. As Melissa had slept alone in that room, Michael on the other side of the river, and the children with him, she had dreamt of him, in dreams made of memories. They were making love on the forest floor on a summer's day, the trees towering above her in the sky. He was sitting by her on the bed at Paradise as she was sleeping, watching over her, the great love, the early man, shining down, the sun coming up in the morning. And now they were walking together across the grass of the University of Greenwich, towards the bank of the Thames, he in a white suit, she in a strapless electric blue dress. A memory of a possibility, a future that had never happened. A part of her still wanted that blue and white picture to happen. She wanted to see him in that white suit, to wear that electric blue dress, to hold his hand and walk together towards the water. But the way was unclear now. She could not get there without losing herself, which she had still not found. What she was experiencing was a strange opening out of herself inside, so that she could sense what she truly, harshly was, the core of it, which was dark and empty and cold, waiting to be filled from within, and she must guard and hold on to it to stop it from breaking. She was woken by the sound from the kitchen, of her mother peeling apples. She woke with a purity of thought, blank and calm, the way she always woke in this room. Soon, Alice came in with the apples and sat down in the armchair next to her. She offered Melissa a quarter. She had put sugar on it. Everything was still and quiet. The butterflies, the milkmaid, the elephants. There was a single candle burning on the mantelpiece for Alice's stillborn child from long ago. "Mum, how did you feel when you left Dad?" Melissa asked. Alice leaned her head back in her armchair and thought. She had never articulated how it had felt.
"It was the right way," she said eventually. "After a very long time, I was going in the right way. I couldn't live with him any more."
"I'm not sure I'm going in the right way," Melissa said. "I don't know what the right way is."
"You find it," said Alice.
"But how do you know?" But there was no reply. Melissa went on to say, the calmness of a few moments ago disappearing, "I don't know myself anymore. I can't seem to find the way back to who I was before."
"Before the children," Alice said, nodding her head slowly. "Children change everything. Family change everything. You must cross the river to the other side of yourself. After that, you find it."
When Melissa heard this, she became very alert, like a small animal caught by a light. She pictured that day, last year, driving across, their loaded red wings and the peace lily, toying with Michael's nostrils. She knew full well her mother meant more than that.
"But I did cross the river,"
she said, in a higher, childish voice. And she knew also that her mother knew that she knew it was more than that.
"You must cross it properly,"
Alice said, offering another piece of unnecessarily sweetened apple. Alice still believed that Melissa and Michael would get back together one day, this month, this week, or next year, just as soon as Melissa had crossed the river properly. She tried a little bit not to go on about it during these visits, but she went on about it.
"He is a good man, much better than your daddy. You get better house and live together as you're supposed to."
Today, she didn't offer the stress buster because Melissa didn't seem stressed or unhappy. But as it was winter, and your babies are always your babies, even when they are 38, she did give her a hot water bottle with a yellow and pink cover that she had crocheted herself, and order her to go and lie down in the living room, which Melissa, of course, obeyed. The hot water bottle went behind her back. The blanket went over her. The children were next to her on the floor, extensions of her, separate, though physically felt, like veins, like ribs, like cubs.
"No, Mum," she said. "I think when I'm older I'd like to live on my own, like you, just like this, where I can be completely myself."
Yet when she slept, the same image came to her, for it was true. She missed him, his boomerang smile, the light by his heart, the whirl of his mahogany waist. The image kept reappearing, waiting at the edges of dreams, drifting by the water, unfolding on the shore. That blue and white day. She in the electric dress, and he in the white suit with khakis underneath. Out they walked from the vaulted rim of the old colonial building of the university. Their families and friends stood and watched as they walked across the green and silver grass, as they approached the black railing that holds back the river. Rhea and Blake ran out to join them, and the four of them became the fine silhouettes of the dusk, four black shapes against the water's gleam. Boats went by. Bridges stood strong. Like a glittering evening shawl, the river wore the night. There they stayed, until all was dark and all the lights had gone out. On New Year's Eve, the Wiley brothers threw their annual NYE bashment. They put the chipboard over the bookshelves, the note on the bathroom mirror telling people that this was someone's house and not a nightclub, and left the Ophili on the centre wall. Melissa and Hazel got ready together in Gypsy Hill. The town was red. They were going to paint it more so. They would shimmer in the notes. They were going to find the perfect meeting of beat and feet. Hazel in 4-inch heels and her fingernails in fuchsia. Melissa with her new hair and charcoal jeans. "Ready," she said in the mirror.
"Looking good," said Hazel.
Pete had come to nothing. He had cheated on her with a removal company administrator who went to his gym. She put on her new jacket, a white puffer with a silver zip. She wasn't so sure about it, if it was for a woman of a certain age.
"Is it too hip-hop?" she said. "You know you could wear a pleated skirt made of Tesco carrier bags and still pull a Pete."
"I don't want to pull a Pete. Pete's a prat. I want an ugly man who will be good to me."
This ugly man turned out to be Bruce Wiley. He was infatuated. They danced together to Busta Rhymes and found the place where the feet met the beat. And while they were making this unexpected electricity, Michael turned up, with a woman he had met at the CD shop in Catford. Melissa said hi. He said hey. She saw his eventual beauty and wondered whether it was also eventual to this new woman or whether it was straight away and therefore lesser. And Michael's first instinct was still to smell her neck for chicken, even though he knew it wasn't there. But somewhere he permanently believed that it would come back, and he wanted to be the one to find it.
"He loves you," Hazel said.
"It's over," Melissa said.
"Chocolate is never over."
Now they were sitting on a wall in Stockwell at 4 a.m. eating chips. While they were sitting there, they happened to witness the last lunar eclipse of the year. They saw the whole thing. The darkness. The intensity of that darkness. Then the light coming back, like a new time.
"Amazing," Hazel said.
"Like being hugged by the night. The salt. The vinegar. The cones were just so."
"These are good chips."
"Yes, they are." Ordinary People is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Penguin Random House Group. Copyright Diana Evans, 2018. Copyright in recording Random House Audiobooks. Diana Evans has asserted her right under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, 1988, to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.